Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon. A fun one this week. Michael Breed, host of the Golf Fix on Golf Channel and A New Breed of Golf on Sirius XM, joins me. We bat around the recent Brandel Chamblee, Rory McIlroy dust up on Twitter, of course. And we talk a little bit about Donald Trump. He works out at a Trump facility, Ferry Point in New York, and it's a beautiful facility, and he's had a chance to talk to Donald Trump, the new president, and see his golf swing. We talk a little bit about his abilities, his handicap, and how much golf we think he'll be playing the next 4 years. But first things first, you can follow us on Twitter at the Clubhouse Pod. You can follow me on Twitter at Shane Bacon. If you go to that Twitter page at Shane Bacon, pinned right atop the page, as easy as I could do it for you, is a link to our new Clubhouse newsletter. We're rolling out on Mondays and Wednesdays, an easy way to get your golf news and such right there. If you sign up, throw your email in there, tell them you're not a robot, and you'll be good to go. And that's an easy way to get links and videos and GIFs and golf course tips and clubs and all that good stuff that we're trying to do on Mondays and Wednesdays, just trying to make it a little easier for you to get your golf news. Michael Breed on the Clubhouse today. We've got a really exciting guest next week as well, so make sure you're subscribing to the podcast so you get all the updates and such and all the new podcasts coming out. Justin Thomas, another winner this past week. We've got a fun one this week. Phil Mickelson's back. He's got a new logo on his shirt. The Jumpman logo, if you will. I don't know how much the vertical was, but the good news is he didn't put any ground on the logo. It was a shot of him from the 2004 Masters, of course, making that great putt on the 72nd hole. I went and watched that Masters, and I'm telling you, for the entirety of that day on Sunday in 04, it looked like that was going to be Ernie Els' chance. And I couldn't believe, looking back and taking a look back at the 2004's Masters, especially on Sunday, the way Ernie played, and really the way Ernie putted. The guy was putting unbelievable. His par save on 16 after hitting it up top right and two-putted that, made an eagle putt. Just an unbelievable round. Really, Ernie's best chance at winning a Masters there, and I can't believe he didn't pull it off. Phil, of course, coming in hot there at the end and that great putt on 18. But a lot of fun to go back and look at that. And of course, now Phil, rolling out the logo on his shirt, said to Golf Channel that he's got something in the works coming up, but he didn't want to talk about it yet. But that's enough of this past week. Make sure you're subscribing to all those things, as we've got a really fun one coming up for you next week. But now, Michael Breed, host of the Golf Fix on Golf Channel, here on the Clubhouse. And we now welcome into the Clubhouse Michael Breed, host of the Golf Fix on Golf Channel at 7 p.m. Easterns on Monday. Also host A New Breed of Golf on Sirius XM Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern. He's also the 2012 PGA Teacher of the Year. Teacher of the Year means you were the best one out there, Michael.
You know what? I was just lucky. The lottery number came up, and I got it.
Well, you know, it's always a bonus. I mean, when the work pays off, it's always a nice thing. But, you know, I wanted to start just because, you know, you're a brain that sees the golf swing way different than a lot of people. So I'm going to call it a twist up, because it was a dust up on Twitter between Brandel Chamblee and Rory McIlroy. Brandel, of course, bringing up the idea this week that hitting down on the golf ball is the most effective way to drive the golf ball. And Rory McIlroy, of course, injured now, replied with some TrackMan data showing that, you know, he hits up on the golf ball, as do a lot of the great drivers right now in the modern game. And that's the best way to get the most out of the swing. Of course, throwing in that strokes gain stat there at the end. I just wanted to ask you, you know the golf swing incredibly well. Who is right in this situation?
Well, the information is overwhelmingly supportive of Rory's, what Rory has done with his golf swing, what the long drivers do, what Justin Thomas does to maximize. And candidly, and this is the interesting thing, Shane, there's a reason why the tee is the length that the tee is at its maximum at 4 inches, because what they know is that the optimal rise angle, if you're going to optimize everything, the optimal rise angle is pretty significant. They say it's somewhere between 12, 13 degrees in an upward strike in an optimal situation, and they don't want to allow that to happen. That tee height, in order to do that, would have to be somewhere near about eight inches to be able to create that severe of a launch angle and optimize the strike and spin and all that other stuff. But they do know that if you're going to maximize your distance, not necessarily maximize your accuracy, but maximize your distance, you have to strike up on the ball, and that's obviously what Rory does. That's what all the long drivers do. They path the club out to the what we would call the draw side or the push side, and then it's moving up. In some cases, Justin Thomas is, you know, in the 4 to 6 degrees up, which is amazing. He's only dealing with about 116 to 118 miles an hour club head speed, which is not near what Bubba Watson does at 128, or even Rory McIlroy for that matter. But yet, because his numbers are so much better, he's getting the most out of his tee shots because of that rise angle.
Yeah, and it's what these modern golf clubs are made to do. I mean, it's something I've been battling with my golf game forever. I go to a TaylorMade or a Ping or a Callaway, and I'll hit some of their new equipment, and you know they always tell me that I hit down on the golf ball, and they always tell me that if I swung a bit more up on it, I'd probably get something like 20, 25 yards more out of my golf swing. So I was interested to see somebody like Brandel, who is, of course, very smart about the golf swing, you know, basically say that if you're hitting down on the golf ball right now, that's the way to play it. It almost seems so old school, like, you know, with the old school golf ball and old school golf club, you know, that was the way it was done. But now everybody's figured out that the best way to hit the ball way, way, way down the fairway is to swing up at impact and get it up in the air and going.
Yeah. And there is some debate as to what you want to do with your swing, because there's sort of what you find is when you start to go up as much as the long drive hitters will, what ends up happening is you really can lose some accuracy. Now, that doesn't mean that if the driver is moving, say, 3 or 4 degrees in an upward direction, that you're going to lose a lot of accuracy. And certainly the distance that you're going to gain has what I believe to be a huge value. I look at golf, the way I look at golf and the way I look at golf courses is it's really about how many par threes you play and what the par threes look like. So if you're driving it on a 400-yard hole and you hit it 200 off the tee, you're playing a 200-yard par three. Whether it's from the fairway or the rough, it's a 200-yard par three. And if I hit it 300 yards off the tee, I'm playing a 100-yard par three. And the fact of the matter is that if my par threes are shorter and I play more of them, I'm going to shoot a lower score than you're going to shoot. So you have to be able to measure that difference between how much distance do you want and where's the accuracy part of it. And I certainly believe that Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas and those individuals have done a phenomenal job of figuring out the absolute perfect rise angle or angle of attack that they need to have to generate the most amount of distance and still maintain their accuracy.
Do you think that these modern players are too obsessed with stuff like TrackMan? Are they too obsessed with their numbers, or is it almost a cheat code in a way to help them understand exactly what they're doing either right or what they're doing wrong?
I think one of the things that all launch monitors are going to do is they're going to allow individuals, players, coaches, whatever, to really understand and measure exactly what's happening rather than sort of guessing what's happening. I liken it to going to go to a doctor who's going to perform a surgery. They have to have an x-ray machine. That x-ray machine is going to tell them exactly what's going on. They might not be able to see through the skin, but the x-ray can do that. And once you see, okay, it's broken in this spot, now there's no guessing. Now all of a sudden we can do this procedure or whatever and get you back on your feet and moving around. And to me, that's what the launch monitors do. It's going to give you an absolute understanding of, okay, here's what you're doing. Your path is moving to the left 5 degrees. We need to get that a little bit different. I use it a lot. It's not something that I completely rely on, but it is certainly something that I use to allow my students to understand, embrace, and then chase the path that I'm trying to get them to go down to improve their game.
Well, I want to get back into some instruction, but I want to go back in your life for a bit, because everybody knows you from your show, and I mean, it's been around since 2008. It's in 80 countries, I read, which is incredibly impressive. But prior to your fame and television show, you were an assistant pro at Augusta National. So
yeah.
I wanted to ask the easy first question. How in the heck does one go about even applying for a job at Augusta National, especially an assistant pro job?
It all has to do with Santa Claus. First, you got to believe, and then you got to ask. That's how it works. No, you know what? life is a very, very interesting thing. And I've been extremely fortunate to be in right places at right times. And so one of the very first jobs that I took in the Metropolitan PGA was working at a small nine-hole club in Westport, Connecticut called Birchwood Country Club. And I went there as an assistant golf pro doing some teaching. One of the kids that worked there, a guy named Larry Tedesco, ended up going to school at Furman to play golf. And it turns out that he was rooming with a guy named Steven Spencer, who happened to be the son of Dave Spencer, who was one of the co-professionals at Augusta National at the time. And Larry and I were good friends, and I went down to visit him at Furman and became good friends with Steven, and met Dave and his wife Barbara and Bob Kletke at the PGA show. And the next thing you know, they asked me to come and work Masters. And so I went down to Augusta for 3 weeks to help out during the Masters tournament for the merchandise program. And it turns out that on one day, one of the members couldn't play. He had invited three guests in and was unable to play. And they sent me out to go play with this member and these
tough guests.
And I ended up going out and shooting 68 and had a great time with all the guests. And the member walked into the pro shop. And of course, he doesn't know that I'm not a full-time employee. And he walks in and said to Dave, "What a fine job you've done hiring your assistants. Michael was absolutely fantastic and he played great. And my guests had a great time." And right after that, they offered me a job to come down and work full time. And of course, nobody says no to that. And I wisely didn't. I said absolutely. And that's how it turned out.
Hey, so you shoot 68 at Augusta National. Is that the first time you'd been around it?
They had me play one time with some other assistants. It was the second time that I had a chance to play the golf course, and needless to say, you know, first time with a member and guests, I was extremely nervous, but it was unlike any other place I've ever been. It's just an amazing spot.
Well, and what was life like, you know, outside of the 1 week a year that everybody focuses on Augusta National? I mean, is it a normal place? I mean, granted, it's got, you know, these very, very high profile members, but I mean, is it a normal situation, much like another country club or a high end country club? Is it different than other places you've been in your past?
Shane, I'll tell you this. I never had so many best friends in my entire life. I had more people calling me, "Hey, Michael, I'm going to be driving through Augusta. Where are you going?" "Well, I'm going from Connecticut to North Dakota." But I thought, you know what? If you're there, I could just swing down and we could play some golf.
Yeah.
I never had, huh?
I was going to say you had to change your number. You're like a celebrity.
I'm telling you, it was incredible. But, you know, this is going back. So I was there in the late 80s and early 90s, and Augusta National, first of all, it holds a dear place in my heart, not just because of what it is, what it stands for, all that, but I'm a huge Alistair McKenzie fan. And, you know, I kind of dabble in that golf course architect space, really trying to understand nuances of each architect. And McKenzie is a guy that I just love his philosophy, the way he designs golf courses. So for me, it's not like any other place because of what it means in the game of golf. Relative to the golf club itself, it was an amazing experience. It's the one thing I can tell you about that place is nobody is in a bad mood on that property. I've never seen guest or member. Nobody's in a bad mood. And that's where it is totally different from other clubs because, you know, people come to the club, they're maybe escaping something or they're having a bad day and they just want to be left alone and hit some balls. When you're at Augusta National, you are having the best time of your life. And oh, by the way, everybody is 8 years old again. I mean, it is the best playground for the adult that there can possibly be. So in that respect, it's not like any other place because there's no place that has that kind of attitude out of every single individual on the property.
One question I've always been interested in, do they take the big scoreboards down after the tournament ends?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a different look.
They take them down. Yeah. It's about a three-week process where they'll start trying to get everything set up, going into tournament. And then pretty much the day after tournament, they are striking everything and taking it all down. And absent of, where the patrons were walking across the fairways and the crosswalks, the golf course looks exactly the same after Masters, maybe a week after Masters.
Well, I've always been interested in people that take a path after trying to play. I mean, you were a player. You already mentioned a great score you put together at Augusta National, but you played in a PGA Tour event. You tried to make a run at that. Was this the goal early in your career, was to try to play for a living?
Interestingly, I wanted to be a baseball player, and that was what I wanted to do. I went to college, a small college down in Virginia called Randolph-Macon College, which was sort of a Division II baseball program, and played in the fall of my freshman year. I played three varsity golf matches and started at shortstop for four of their fall games. And in fact, we played the University of Richmond, which was a Division I program, and we beat them, which was really fun because my oldest brother had gone to school with the University of Richmond. So I had gone down there with the intention of playing baseball. And when my oldest brother, who was a really good baseball player, didn't get drafted, I kind of figured I've got to find another sport. And so, golf was where I was going to go. And I was playing some golf and not bad and trying to figure out if I was any good. And turned out that I was pretty good. I wasn't as good as I needed to be, but I was pretty good and certainly worth trying to see if I could make it. Played a number of events on what was then the Ben Hogan Tour. And learned very quickly after that experience that I was just not as good as those other guys. And then quickly after that found that, teaching was my calling. That was the thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to help people play better golf. I wanted to understand the golf swing. I couldn't understand why I was not able to perform at the level that I wanted to perform. And I wanted to know everything about how and why you do what you do with a golf club to get the ball to go the distances that you want it to go with the consistencies that you hope. So that was what that was all about.
Well, and you mentioned Randolph-Macon. I just want to say my grandmother went to Randolph-Macon. I think at the time she went,
it was
an all-women's school. Yeah, I was checking your profile and saw that. My sister almost went there as well. So you almost had two Randolph-Macons through the Bacon family. I know a lot of people probably don't know where that place is, but it's rare. I'm sure you run into people that know an alumni there. But I was going to ask, I had a moment. I tried to play mini tour golf, and I had a moment. And I've actually had a few friends of mine tell me they had a moment as well. It's that moment you realize, man, I'm not as good as these guys. And my moment was, I remember I grinded out a round in a mini tour event. I shot 68. I birdied 17 and 18, and I was on a high. I felt great. I'd played a solid round. And I remember talking to a guy on a putting green following the round. He was hitting some putts, and I said, how'd you play? And he goes, I played okay. And later I checked his score, and he shot 66. And I thought to myself, if 66 is okay for him and I'm on cloud nine with 68, maybe this isn't for me. Did you have a moment like that where you thought, damn, these guys are just better than I am?
I had a couple of moments. I can tell you several of them. One of them was, I was down there in Orlando playing those mini tours as you discussed, and I went out and I played. It was a really, really windy day. There was a guy that was down there named Roy Biancalana. And Biancalana, on this day that I had played one of the best rounds I'd played, I shot 70, I flighted my ball well, and it's just one of those days that if you got it to 15 feet, you hit an unbelievable shot. And Biancalana, by the way, couldn't keep his card. He had it and he lost it and he had it and he lost it. And I came in with 70 and I was all kinds of fired up, and he'd shot 63. And I just went, I couldn't figure out how I could have shot 63. And then the next day the guy goes out and shoots 64. And I literally thought to myself, I'm just not that good. And then I had an experience a couple of weeks later where I was playing with Steve Lowry. You might know that name. He was on tour for a long, long time.
For sure.
And we went out and played. And again, it was another one of those rounds where, you know, I played really consistent golf. I had it to about 4 under par, 5 under par at one point. I don't remember, but I remember coming in and shooting 3 under. He went out and he shot 40 on the front nine. And I thought, as I'm out there, I'm thinking, man, I'm a really good player. Here I am. This guy's a tour pro. I'm out there doing what I'm doing. He's shooting 40. He goes out, he shoots 29 on the back nine, and he missed 2 putts inside of 10 feet. He hit driver on a hole that I couldn't barely walk in because it was so narrow. And it was the easiest 29 I've ever seen in my life. And I went from, you know, Bob Gibson wrote a book called From Ghetto to Glory. And it was a story about his life, about how he went from the ghettos and then going to Major League Baseball and what that was all about. And I literally, that whole day with Steve Lowry, we had lunch afterwards, I called from glory to ghetto because I thought I was really, really good. And I found out I was not that good. And it was time for me to go on and find a new direction.
And it's funny, you have those instances where you play with somebody and you just realize that person's talent is at a different level. One of my good friends growing up, he was 4 or 5 years older than me, but you know, he played collegiate golf and he had a lot of accolades playing collegiate golf. And he told me this story. You know, he's one of the better ball strikers I've really ever played golf with. He told me he played a round of golf one day in about 40-mile-an-hour winds, like you said, tough conditions, and he got done, and the guy he was playing with shot 5 or 6 under, and he said he called his dad on the way home and said, remember this name, and the guy he played with was Bubba Watson. You know, and it's just, you see it in this guy. He's playing a Tight Lies Tour event in Texas and plays with, you know, a left-hander with a, I think he said Bubba had painted his shaft pink at that time because, of course, manufacturers weren't making them pink, you know, themed golf clubs. But it's funny when you see that. I mean, you know, you hear these stories of these guys that see them and go, oh man, that guy's got something different. But of course, you go into instruction, and then, as we've talked about, Golf Fix comes around in 2008. But how did that idea come about? How long have you been thinking about a show like this, and how did you go about pitching something like that to Golf Channel and them, you know, eventually going, yeah, we love the idea, let's run with it?
So it's really interesting. So I was very fortunate to be able to get involved with Golf Channel back in 1999. I did one of their instructional programs back in 1999. In fact, it was during Masters Week, and I went down, and it was a 2-day show. It was a Tuesday-Wednesday show. They canceled the Wednesday show, and they had me on Golf Talk Live with Peter Kessler and Mark Lai.
The voice of God, Peter Kessler.
And, yep. And that was also the year that Augusta National added the second cut. And so during that time, I had been down there, and I had played so many rounds of golf at Augusta National. I can't count, but I would bet you that in the time that I was down there, I played at least 300 to 400 rounds of golf. I mean, I was out there all the time. And so when we're sitting on the set, and obviously I'm fairly nervous, but we got into a conversation about the effects that was going to have on the players. And I told them that I thought it was going to be very harmful to the American player, that I thought that the European player was going to be more successful, and they would look at a lie and they would flight a ball down and keep it low, where the game of golf over there was a lower game and the game of golf in America was a higher game. And I felt that that was going to be conducive to a European player winning, and 3 or 5 days later, whatever it was, Ola Thabel goes out and wins. And all of a sudden, I know what I'm talking about. I mean, it literally was that fast. And then they hired me to do some on-course commentary. Anyway, in 2002, they asked me to present to them some ideas. Well, I had been hatching this show in my mind since 1986 called A New Breed of Golf, and it was an instructional show. I was so tired of watching instructional shows where they basically had 2 angles, the camera face on and the camera down the line, and it never moved. There was no movement, and there was no energy. There was no passion. It was just a very sort of mundane kind of program, and there was no entertainment value. And I wanted to change that. So when they asked me for it, I presented to them this pilot that we had done for a new breed of golf. And I handed it to a gentleman who looked at it and he said, "Michael, in all honesty, I would be so tired after watching your show. I don't think it's for us." And 6 short years later, a gentleman came into his office and said, "Do you have any new talent or any new ideas?" He reached into his drawer. He handed him the DVD and he said, "What do you think about this?" And a month later, I was on the phone with Tom Stathakis and Tony Tortorici, and they had offered me this idea. They wanted to get back into the instructional platform. There weren't any instructional shows on Golf Channel for a couple of years. They had been doing this show called The Turn, which was sort of a combination of highlights from the PGA Tour and, you know, an instructional shot or an instructional segment within the body of the show. And they wanted to get into a full-time instructional program. And they chose me to do it. And it's just been an unbelievable ride, really an unbelievable ride.
Well, I've been fascinated by the idea of hands-off instruction for a long time. And when I say hands-off, I simply mean you not being in the same room or on the driving range or in a bay with somebody. You know, simply you can grab their arm or show them the path they're going. How much has social media helped somebody like you not only get in touch with fans, but help people that are actually working on something that you said on the show? Has social media been a big gift to you?
I think, you know, social media has sort of happened, honestly, that real social media drive has kind of happened since the inception of the show. We used to take phone calls. When we first started, we had a phone and people would call in and we would take their call and then we would help them. But what I can tell you, and what's an interesting thing about the game of golf is this: 80% of the people that play the game don't take golf lessons. That's 4 out of 5 people. You know, that four out of five dentists survey recommend.
Exactly.
Yeah. 4 out of 5 people don't take a golf lesson. And that means they still love the game. They still want to get good at it and they still seek the information. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to get it however they can get it, whether it's YouTube or Google or whatever. And I do think that what really helps the show is that people don't go see a PGA professional to understand how to hit a golf ball where you want to hit a golf ball. I think that's the one great advantage. I think the social media thing and what will happen in the future, I think we are about to step into a completely different realm in all this instructional space. But I do think now it's a huge part of it. I mean, I'm doing a lot of Facebook Lives and I'm doing a lot of, obviously with the radio show as well, I get to answer questions from people, but I'm doing a lot of stuff on Twitter, trying to help people understand what is going on. One of the things that you obviously know, having played a lot, you would go out and you would play great one day and the next day you would play totally the opposite end. You might shoot 68, 78. And not have an understanding at all why the ball was doing what the ball was doing. And now I think you've got a better educated player and you've got a student that's not a student, but a student of the game that wants to know, how can I improve? And they seek the information out themselves. It's the DIY kind of mindset. I'm going to build my own house. I'm going to put my own stairs in. I'm going to learn how to hit a golf ball all by myself. And that's really where the social media, I think, is a huge asset.
Well, and what's a big point that you really try to hammer home with not just amateurs, but amateurs that come to you and say they're struggling? Is there something that you really try to put in their mind that they can take with them when they go to the range and on the golf course and for the next few weeks after talking to you or interacting with you on the radio?
Absolutely. Most people, and really the sort of the sexy part of the golf swing is understanding what the stick is doing. In other words, when you're swinging around, is it on plane? Is it across the line? Is it underneath? You know, all that stuff. We think about what the stick is doing, what the path of the golf club is doing. we don't pay as much attention to what's happening with the face. One of the reasons why is that it's hard to really know where the face is. You can kind of, you can see the divot and go, well, I swung the club this way, so I must have done X, which is obviously not true. But most people are trying to figure out how to improve their game by controlling what's happening with the path of the club. And when I ask students, whether they're mine or students of the game, which is more important, path or face, the large majority of people will say path. And the truth is that it's face. And face is something we don't pay attention to. That's why, you know, forever we heard the grip is the most important thing. It is the most important thing because it's your control to the face. And you have to be able to understand what's happening with the face. Why did the ball go to the right? Because the face was over there. Why did the ball go to the left? Because the face was over there. And so what people don't understand and what people don't look at and fix last is what's happening with the face. The other thing that people don't pay attention to is what happens in pre-swing. So, you know, today's obviously the inauguration. You're thinking about presidents. One of the great presidents, Abraham Lincoln, said, if I have 8 hours to cut down a tree, I'm going to spend 6 hours sharpening my axe. And what that means is preparation, preparation, preparation. And so when I'm telling my students, when they go out to go play and they're struggling with making a turn or they're struggling hitting the ball on the toe or whatever it is, what I want them to do is look at what's happening in your pre-swing before you look at what's happening with in-swing. So if you don't have an ability, if you're on a certain day not turning as well as you could have, well, maybe it's because at a dress you've got your weight too much out on your toes. Or maybe when you're getting set up, you're setting up with so much weight on your right side that you're falling into your left side in the backswing. Look at what's happening in what you're doing in your pre-swing, and then in most circumstances, that will solve what's happening in your in-swing. So I would say two things for the average person. Think about what's happening with the face to understand what's happening with your ball, and think about what is occurring in your pre-swing situation and how that could be affecting your in-swing motion.
Well, you've worked with a lot of pros. I was looking at some of the list of names that you've worked with over the years, and a pro obviously plays golf completely different than an amateur does. When a pro comes to you that's struggling a bit, is the issue normally a mechanical issue, a golf swing issue, or are you seeing it's normally mental for these guys that obviously know how to go out there and play golf?
It can be a whole host of things, and what I can tell you is that they – each player has their own little idiosyncrasies that they will fall into. So, for instance, one of the players that I work with, when they go and play in wind, they tend to, all of a sudden, if I see them a short period of time after they've had a couple of weeks in the wind, they will be bending over a little bit more from the waist. The ball position will be a little bit farther back in their stance, and they won't be making a real shift to their right side or trail side in the backswing because they've gotten so used to hitting the ball low and flighting it down. So everybody can fall into these little idiosyncrasies. What I can tell you about working with elite players is as follows. One, they were really good before I saw them, and they're going to be really good after they're finished seeing me because they're really talented people. And so that's, I always start there. And the second thing that I try to do is I try to get their brain to understand the little nuances through asking questions. So I might say, well, why did the ball go to the right? Well, my face was open. Okay, what controls the face? Well, my grip is in an improper position, or I've got it shut, or I've got it open, or I'm standing, whatever. Get them to understand the little cause and effect of what's happening. And then, okay, what's the path that we need to go down? And believe it or not, and this is why I said it's a combination of both, because when somebody is playing, particularly elite level players, and you've seen this and you've done it yourself, you go out, there are those days where you just aim at pins because you know exactly that you're going to hit it right there. There's no doubt in your mind. And that's what happens with these guys. Once they have confidence and trust in what they're doing, they will play great. Even the smallest of changes, like moving your ball position 1 inch forward instead of 1 inch back, and all of a sudden trajectory starts coming up and trust comes back and they see the target differently, and then boom, and then they go, my tempo was great. And it really is with tour pros, it's very, very small things for great success.
Well, you mentioned the inauguration. You mentioned the presidency. You, of course, work at Ferry Point, a Trump property just outside of New York. You know, it's a big day for Donald Trump, and I'm assuming it's a big day for you as well. And I wanted to ask, have you ever given, I guess I can say it now, have you ever given our new president a golf lesson?
I have not given him a formal lesson, but we have had conversations about how he can hit the ball a little bit better. What I can tell you is that President Trump is very involved and invested in the game of golf, and he's got, I think, 19 golf courses that are Trump properties. And obviously you can understand that with that comes a lot of golf professionals that are with him. So he's got plenty of information. Mickey Gallagher is a guy who's down there in New Jersey. He's getting inundated with information about how he should or shouldn't hit a golf ball. But I think over the next 4 years, that's probably going to be down the list of his importance trying to win another club championship.
Well, yeah, we hear a lot about Trump's golf game. And I mean, you know, you hear that he's a 2 handicap and he shoots in the 70s regularly. I actually played Ferry Point a couple of years ago. There's a plaque on the 8th hole about a hole in one he made in the first round. Is his golf game that good? Is he a 2 handicap?
You'd be surprised. He is, first of all, he is incredibly passionate about the game of golf. There are few people that I have seen outside of the professional space that love the game of golf the way he loves the game of golf. And obviously, one of the things that happens when you have that kind of passion is you're going to cultivate it. You're going to make sure that you know, you're out there working on it and playing. And there were times, and I know, you know, 30 years ago, where he played some really good golf. He's a member at Wingfoot. I mean, you got to be able to hit the ball where you're looking if you're going to play golf around there. I don't know if you got a chance to run around those two tracks.
Yes, I have, and you're
pretty
right.
Good. And if you get into it, it's not easy. So, he's a really good player. I think that handicap, though, is going to probably go up just a little bit over the next 4 years. I don't see him standing on the ranges and doing any practicing here soon.
No, he's probably not going to spend a ton of time, but I would bet a decent amount of money that we will see a putting green somewhere around the White House in the next few months that somebody puts in. Michael, I really appreciate the time. I love everything you do. I love the passion you have for the game and love catching. You can catch him on the Golf Fix. Catch him on Sirius XM Radio. I appreciate the time. Hope you have a great week. And really enjoy, as you said, Ferry Point and what's going to come with now President Trump.
Thanks, Shane. I appreciate it. And as I say the same, I've admired all the work you're doing, and I love hearing your insights and your thoughts in the game of golf. It's really refreshing. Well done.
Many thanks to Michael Breed. Many, many thanks. A lot of fun talking to him about Augusta and Donald Trump and just the ins and outs of a golf swing. You know, it's so interesting. We try so hard and work so hard. I found it amazing that 80% of players don't go to an instructor. I find this funny as well. There's two things that you need to do if you're a golfer. First, if you haven't re-gripped your clubs in a few years, go do that right now. It's the one place your hands actually touch the golf club. So many players get new drivers every year, a new putter all the time. They're always doing this and that. They've got the super stroke on there. They're putting lines on their golf balls, yet they have these ratty grips. So go get your golf clubs re-gripped. Throw down $150. It's totally worth it. And the other thing that I think so many players forget to do is check the grooves on your wedges. This is very important. You hit a lot of wedges. You hit a lot of sand wedges and pitching wedge and lob wedge around the green and from 100 yards and in. You know, they say that's the scoring area. Yet, your grooves have been beat to hell. Make sure you go get new wedges. It's not an overly expensive golf club to buy, and it will immediately help your golf game. I can guarantee it. Just being able to spin and control the golf ball off the face, especially in conditions like right now in January and February, you know, a time where controlling the golf ball is extremely important. You know, the golf courses might be wet. It might have rained. It's important to get new wedges. So those are my two tips since we're talking about golf instruction with Michael. Again, many thanks to Michael. Make sure you're subscribing to that Clubhouse newsletter if you haven't already. It's pinned to top my Twitter page, at Shane Bacon. And also, if you go to Facebook, look up Shane Bacon Golf or Facebook.com/Shane Bacon Golf. We're going to be rolling out some Facebook Live stuff over the next few weeks with Fox Sports. So it'll be a partnership there, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to do a mailbag next week there on Facebook Live. So make sure you go there and follow so you can keep up to date with all of that. Next week, a big, big guest. We're really excited about it. Everybody, I hope you get in some rounds. I know it's raining a lot in the West. I know it's raining in Arizona right now. I'm debating if I'm even going to play golf on Friday. I know that's a real warm place person problem to have. But if you get out, have some fun, make some birdies, and we'll check back with you next week.